Well, what I wanted to talk today about is some very, very recent work as of the last few weeks on the dispersal of disks around low-mass stars that I've been doing with Uma Gordy and Case Dulemon. But it's been a part of a project that's been going on for more than 10 years. And in fact, Doug Johnston, who's in the audience, was one who embarked on this whole process with me back in the early 90s, actually. And we started looking at how disks disperse and particularly how they photoevaporate. So the just to give you a little observational background on the topic is that planet-forming disks around low-mass stars start off with disk masses that are probably around the order of a tenth of the solar mass, of the stellar mass that they're orbiting. And that's because the infall probably feeds the disk until the disk gets gravitationally unstable, which is at about this mass. And then eventually the infall stops, and then so the disk starts with a mass of this order. Oh, now, observationally...
Question? Yeah, so on when you say at about 0.1 solar mass, so what mass star are you thinking of?
Well, this is the mass of the star.
Oh, the mass of the star. Okay.
The tenth of the mass of the star is where they tend to get gravitationally unstable. So more massive stars will have somewhat more massive disks. Now, observationally, actually, the numbers are a little less than this. They sort of range between 0.01 to 0.1 solar masses. But there's a lot of uncertainties as to what they measure it by looking at the dust in the submillimeter, and there's uncertainties in this. So from a theoretical point of view, you would expect it to be about a tenth of a solar of the stellar mass is going to be in a disk of gas and dust. Now, well, the other observational fact is that the inner disk gets optically thin in dust in a few mega years. That's seen in near-infrared observations of the continuum from this dust. The inner dust is quite hot. It radiates a lot between 2 and 10 microns, and you just see it disappear within a few million years. The dust mass in the outer disk also greatly diminishes in about the same time. And that's seen in the submillimeter, which is looking at the dust emitting at submillimeter wavelengths, the colder dust. And you can see that mass disappear in the same sort of few million year time scale, maybe 2 to 3 million years. Now, there are some cases, although typically when the inner disk goes, the outer disk also goes, more or less, at about the same time. But there are some cases where we see optically thin inner disk, in other words, a hole in the inner disk, but we see optically thick outer disks as sort of a torus around the stars. And finally, most of this initial mass of 0.1 mass of the star does not go into planets. We've now observed enough systems, and of course we know our own solar system, and we can count up the mass in the planets, and there's not anywhere near 0.1 of the mass of the star in planets. So most of this gas and dust gets dispersed. It either goes into the star or it gets blown out into the interstellar medium. And so I've been working on the various mechanisms that will disperse it. And just to keep the talk short, the bottom line is that there are two basic mechanisms, I think, that disperse the gas and the dust. One is viscous spreading and accretion. If you have a source of viscosity, of turbulent viscosity in disks, then what that does is it redistributes angular momentum and material spirals into the star and actually accretes onto the star. And a small amount kind of spreads out. The angular momentum goes to a small amount that spreads. And this is often treated with this alpha disk formalism, where alpha is a dimensionless parameter that characterizes all our uncertainties as to what really the viscosity is. And typically, if you put in values of alpha of 10 to the minus 2, you get the evolution of the accretion rates in disks to come out about what is observed. There's also some theoretical work done on this magneto-rotational instability, which suggests that alpha might be of that order of 10 to the minus 2. So that's one thing that happens. You get this spreading and spiraling in of the material. The other thing that happens is photoevaporation. And this photoevaporation can either occur by an external O star shining on a nearby low-mass star and evaporating. These proplids that are seen in Orion are cases like that. I'm not going to talk about that today. I just want to talk about, imagine you have a low-mass star in a more benign environment where it's just the radiation from the central star that's going to evaporate the disk. So what is evaporation? What is this photoevaporation? What it is you have a star, and you have this disk, which is the green, that's the cold disk, And the star emits both ultraviolet X-ray photons, and they illuminate the surface of the disk, and they actually heat the gas up on the surface of the disk, much hotter than in the midplane. And so what that does is that in the inner regions of the disk, the gravity of the star is actually strong enough to, even though you have a hot surface, it produces sort of a hot corona on the disk that's bound. But you get out beyond a certain critical radius, and then the thermal speeds of the hydrogen become comparable to the escape speed from the system. And so thermal pressure basically drives an outflow. It's like a thermal, almost like a Parker wind in the sun, which is a thermal wind too. Only that's a million degree gas. This gas is of order hundreds to 10,000 degrees. So there's two types of radiation that heat the disk. You got Lyman continuum photons from the sun, sort of the photons that ionize hydrogen, and they heat the surface up to 10,000 degrees. And if you just think about the EUV, then what that does, 10,000 degree gas, the flow starts at just a few AU out in a one solar mass star. And in fact, if you do the rate of transfer, most of the flow occurs just beyond this critical radius, and the flow diminishes quite rapidly out beyond it. So what EUV tends to want to do is burn a hole in the disk at a few AU. That's the Lyman continuum photons. And then you can look at FUV photons, which are less energetic than 13.6 electron volts, or X-rays, which heat the neutral gas. They tend to cause photoevaporation further out because they don't heat it as hot. They only heat it to 100 or 1,000 degrees. And so they evaporate the disk further out at, say, 50, 100 AU. And they tend to work from the outside in. They evaporate the outside first, and then they kind of work their way in. And so you got these two processes going on simultaneously.
Great. Are you going to explain that a little bit more about why one is inside out and the other is outside in?
I wasn't going to go into much detail about that. Actually, I will come to a view graph, and I'll come to a view graph, and I'll try to remember to go into some more detail at that point on that. So what we've been doing in my group is to try to model a central star, which emits X-rays and Lyman continuum photons, or the EUV and the FUV photons, optical photons. And then you have a disk here of gas and dust particles. And, of course, the dust particles aren't like interstellar dust particles. Often we treat them as being coagulated so that there's less surface area in the dust than the gas. And that actually is one of our free parameters, is exactly what the dust properties are in our models. But we treat the dust as a distribution of dust sizes. And then we actually calculate the gas temperature, which does not necessarily equal the dust temperature. At the midplane, the densities are so high that they very closely couple and they are equal. But as you go up in the disk, the gas can be heated by these X-rays and UV photons hotter than the dust. And so they start to get unequal as you get up higher. I'm going to show some results in just a second about that. So in these models, what we're trying to do is self-consistently calculate the chemistry, because the chemistry in the gas determines the cooling, which determines the gas temperature. We got to calculate the heating due to the X-rays and the UV, and then the cooling. We got to do the rate of transfer of these the cooling lines trying to escape out. Sometimes these transitions get optically thick. We've got to do the vertical and radial structure of the density and the temperature. This is what we're after. And then we're trying to get the dynamics of this flow that happens. So it's a complicated problem, and in fact, we've made some simplifications, and our code even now takes a week to do one run. So here's some results from just a, this is just a cut at 9 AU in one of our models where you get the heating of the disk from the central star. And so this is going up vertically in height from the midplane here up to 8 AU in height. And this is, first of all, what's plotted is the temperature of the gas and dust. This is the temperature of the gas and dust. And at this point, as you get up higher in Z, they start to depart. Here, the gas and dust are at the same temperature. Then here, the dust temperature reaches its sort of surface, where it's basically this dust is just seeing the star, and it's just getting heated directly by the radiation from the star with very little attenuation between it and the star. And you get dust temperatures up to a couple hundred degrees at 10 AU or 9 AU. But this is the gas, and you can see that the gas, as you get up, once the gas starts seeing the stellar photons, it starts getting hotter because it's getting warmed by the UV photons and the X-rays. And you can see that the gas gets hotter, and eventually you have these Lyman continuum photons producing 10,000 degree gas. It's like a little H2 region on the top. And then this is gas heated by the FUV and the X-rays up to, you know, a range of temperatures going from hundreds to a couple few thousand degrees.
What's your mid-plane scale height?
Pardon?
What's your mid-plane scale height?
The mid-plane scale height?
9 AU.
Yeah, it's. I think it's on the order of an AU or so.
Okay, so that's basically this bit in the bit.
Well, you can see the density. Yeah, this is a plot of the density, and you can see the density dropping. These are all self-consistent models where we, once we know the gas temperature, we can, do the...
But where your decoupling is happening, you're above most of the mass.
That's right. Oh, yeah. No, this is
really a surface effect.
This is a tiny bit of mass up here where this is happening. I mean, if the disk starts off with a tenth of the solar mass, let's say, this mass here is on the order of Earth masses. I mean, it's really quite small compared with the mass down at the midplane here where the densities are high. Yeah, there's very little mass up there. But what happens is that you get evaporation, and that's just, even though it's just a small layer, it evaporates, and then it goes deeper, and it evaporates the next layer, and it just keeps going. And over a period of time, you can get rid of a lot of material.
Sorry, very basic question.
Sure.
So you said you're pulling all chemical compositions, so it includes every single ion for the metals and as well, and also.
Yeah, we have we have somewhat simplified chemistry. We have about 60 species and about 400 reactions.
Including radiative transfer to radiation is also.
Yes, the radiative transfer is complicated. Well, there's two things. Of course, you have to treat the penetration of the UV and X-rays into the disk, which comes in sort of obliquely through the inner radii to the outer radii.
So spectrum is coming.
And then the other thing, the radiative transfer, is of course that when you calculate the cooling, sometimes the lines that are trying to cool are optically thick, and so we do it in an escape probability formalism of escaping out the surface of the disk.
So it's non-equilibrium as well.
Non-equilibrium. It's all done. It's the assumption is steady state, and that needs to be examined in some cases. But we do assume steady state thermal balance, that is heating equals cooling, and steady state chemistry, and steady state populations too. I mean, you know, you have collisions, and you have you calculate the steady state populations of all the levels of the various cooling species. So what I have on here is, just to give you some of the basic chemistry on this plot, this is the height at which AV equals 1 to the star. So below this, you have a very high extinction to the star. And above this, higher Z, you have virtually no extinction to the star. And you can see that's sort of the point where the temperature of the gas and dust start to depart from each other. The other thing you see is this is where the CO, there's CO below this, the midplane part is all CO, and above this it turns into C plus. And this is a place where H2 goes from H2 to H. So you can see they're sort of at the AV equal 1, it's a little bit higher. H2 tends to self-shield. And the densities here are very high. Notice that what kind of densities are we talking about in this sort of interesting region here? You can see the densities we're talking about are on the order of 10 to the 8th particles per cc. I mean, we're not talking about interstellar densities. It's pretty high. And
still decouple the dust from the gas.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
How are you going to get dust at 6 scale heights? I mean, don't you expect something to settle out at this stage?
Right. So the settling is a very interesting question. Excuse me. So what we do is, in this code, we don't do the settling. The people like Dominic and Dulamond have looked at settling of dust grains. And if you just let them settle and do nothing else, they settle so fast that everything goes to the midplane. Now, observationally, we know that's not true. We see dust up high, this warm dust up high that's smaller. So what they have to appeal to is that there's enough turbulence and enough shattering that you just are resupplying the dust. So that makes the amount of dust and its properties very uncertain in this. So what we tend to do in our standard models is we allow the dust distribution. It's not an interstellar dust distribution that goes to 0.1 or 0.2 microns. It's a distribution where we actually have a maximum size that we vary usually between 20 microns to a millimeter in size. And that reduces the, allows for coagulation. It reduces the amount of area. We don't settle. We can settle, but we haven't tried that yet. I mean, we can put any kind of dust properties in as we want. So we have the same dust at the surface as we do at the midplane. I mean, the same dust properties at surface and midplane in the models that I'll show.
And the same dust to gas ratio. So the scale height of the dust and gas is the same.
Right. Right. But as I say, the dust is reduced in opacity because we've assumed that either through settling or through coagulation. And of course, what's the only thing that's important to us is this surface material. And so we don't really care if we get the dust properties right in the midplane because the dust and gas are at the same temperature and it doesn't really matter. So what we just need to vary is the, what's the properties of this dust up here at sort of AV of 1 or higher, because that does matter for the gas temperature. Yeah.
Yeah, Dave. Are you going to discuss the constraints which are provided on these disks by the fact that H2 is not detected in this kind of disks?
Yeah, well, H2 is detected in some cases.
Barely.
And in fact, our predictions for the H2 are right on to on what the observations are from these models.
I'm mentioning the unpublished data by John Lacey and
yeah, well, Lacey. The, Matt Richter and Lacey have seen in a few cases, like in A or yeah.
In most cases, they didn't.
But the numbers that they get are very close to our predictions for the H2 emission. And so there's nothing. In fact, one of the points I was going to make with this view graph is that I can't go into that now. But part of this work is to actually predict spectrum from disks and then compare the spectrum to what we're observing. And there are a number of lines that have now been observed. There's been neon 2 lines that have been observed at 12.8 microns, which comes from this ionized layer and also from some X-ray heated gas down here. There's iron 1 that's been observed, and that comes from deeper down here where the iron goes to iron 1. Sorry, it's timing out or something. And then, as Adit says, there's H2 emission, which is generally not seen, but in a few cases has been seen. But our predictions for the line strengths, this is the pure rotational lines of H2, are right pretty close to what Lacey has seen. And the upper limits that, in other cases, one of the problems with the H2 lines is line to continuum. And that's, in fact, a problem in general for all the lines, is that, unfortunately, Spitzer, when it looked for it, now Tuxedes has less of a problem, but it doesn't have quite the sensitivity as Spitzer, but Spitzer, when it looked for it, had such pure spectral resolution that the line to continuum was a real problem because the continuum is so strong. And so the lines were a very small fraction of the continuum in a given sort of spectral element. So, but the, and in fact, one of the places where we tend to see the neon too is when there's an inner hole in these disks, because then you get less continuum at 12 microns because you don't have the hot dust in that inner hole. And then you, but the line still is pretty strong because it comes from out at 1020 AU. But anyway.
Dave, well, everyone's on this one view graph. Let's see how many minutes we can keep it up. The other thing, as you showed right at the beginning, is there is flow going on. And even if you're evaporating stuff at the top, there's a flow. How are you doing the kinematic?
Okay, we.
Are you just assuming a sort of geometry?
Yeah, the thing that we do is for the neutral flow, I mean, for the ionized flow, we did what we did back in the 94 paper. That is 10,000 degrees, and we calculate the flow from that. From the neutral flow, it starts off subsonic because this critical radius where you really get a lot of flow ends up being at like 100 or 200 or 300 AU. And so it starts off in a very slow subsonic flow. And because it's a slow subsonic flow, what we're assuming is that the dynamics doesn't affect the chemistry or the temperature very much. And so what we do is we do this steady state solution for the temperature and the density, and then we do the streamlines. So if you have that temperature and density, what kind of flow would you get from a given radius? So that's how we do it.
Have to try once more.
Oops. Try it again.
Oh, wait. Oh, no.
Ah. What happened? I think it's back here. Okay. So, This is the view graph. I want to go back to Chris's point. So what I've done here is for a typical case, this is of a one solar mass star. Again, we're starting off initially with a disk that's 0.1 of the solar mass. The stellar luminosity is assumed to be 2.3 L sun because we're looking at a young one solar mass star. The X-ray luminosity, this is from observations, this order, the FUV luminosity of the same order, the X-rays, and the EUV of the same order. There isn't much observation of this, so this is a pretty much of a guess for the EUV. But the X-rays, and these two have sort of been observed. This is actually low. If the disk is accreting onto the star, you can get bigger values than this. In this case, we're just assuming that there's not too much accretion onto the star, and you just are getting FUV from the chromosphere of the star in this young phase. But these two sort of correspond to the observations. This one is a sort of a guess, given that these two have similar numbers. But here's what happens. What I'm plotting here is a kind of a time scale. It's the surface density of the disk divided by the mass flux from the photoevaporative flow in years. And so on the inside of the disk, because gravity holds it, you hardly get any mass flux in photoevaporation, so you get very long time scales. I mean, short time scales means the disk is being photoevaporated here. So then you get to the point where the thermal speed is equal to the escape speed from the system at about an AU, and the EUV starts to give you very short time scales, less than a million years, to basically evaporate. In other words, if nothing else was happening in the disk, if it didn't have any viscosity, there was no rearrangement of material, then this would be the time that the EUV would take to burn a hole at 1 AU, which would be a few times 10 to the fifth years. Okay? And then the reason that the EUV is dropping is that the mass flux from the EUV is dropping faster than the surface density is dropping. The mass flux from the EUV due to the rate of transfer in the EUV is dropping as roughly R to the minus 5 halves, whereas the surface density in these disks we've assumed to only go as R to the minus 1. And so you just have more material, less flux, and so the time scales get longer for the EUV. And that's why the EUV burns a hole. But the reason that the FUV works from outside in is because the FUV and the X-rays are only heating the gas up to like 100 degrees. And the critical radius where you really get a lot of flow is actually more like several hundred AU. So you're way inside this critical radius. So you're just getting subsonic flow. So you're sort of like on this part of the EUV curve is an equivalent thing here, that the further out you are, the less bound you are, and easier it is to get off. And so it takes the easiest material to get off first, and then it starts working its way slowly in from the outside in. Now, the thing is that two things are going on. It's not just evaporation. It's like what I said, there is this viscosity that's rearranging materials. And this is something that Kathy Clark has worked on and Doug has worked on, where you really need to do both things at once. Because what really happens is that here's the time scale for viscosity to move material radially around. It's sort of the time scale to move things a factor of 2 in radius. And this is for an alpha of 3 times 10 to the minus 3. And you can see that these time scales are shorter than the evaporation time scales. And what that means is that as this stuff tries to evaporate a hole, material is being transported by viscosity to replace that hole from this outer mass reservoir of the disk. Most of the mass of the disk is out here. And you can see the time scales are here for the evaporation are much longer. And so viscosity takes this reservoir and replaces this material. Until finally, you've got the rate at which it's replacing material equals the photoevaporation rate, and then you burn a hole in the disk at that point. But the critical criterion is that the accretion rate due to viscosity inward is equal to the photoevaporation rate. When that happens, then you burn a hole, because then the material just comes in and then it just flows out, and nothing replenishes the inside material, which then all just accretes onto the star. You'll see that in the simulations that I wanted to show you, which are next. So this is the really recent work that I did with Case Dulamond and Uma Gorti. So the first case here is where we don't have any photoevaporation. It's just viscosity. And we actually started off with a disk that had a sort of a truncation at about 200 AU. So you can see that even after 1 million years, that has spread a bit. And then you can see up to 10 million years viscosity, what it does is that it, you're actually losing mass.
Okay, so what in this first million years, what's that feature at
here? Okay. It is caused, in CASE's code, they have accretion heating. And so what happens is when you get in here, the accretion heating is starting to affect the inner disk. And he also has a thing in there where if the dust gets hotter at the midplane than 1500 K, he assumes there's a kind of a regulation that goes on that then sets the temperature in the midplane equal to 1500 K. But mainly the thing that's happening is that you're going from a situation where the accretion heating is starting to affect the structure of the disk, the temperature. And, of course, when you do an alpha disk, the temperature matters in terms of the accretion rate. So you get that kink.
The power law, since the temperature isn't a power law, I get the feature. Is
that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is, but this is not important for this talk, but that's what that kink is. But what you see is that the disk, after 10 million years, has dropped in mass because this is where the reservoir of mass, most of the mass is out here. Surface density is going as 1 over R. So the mass is going as R as you go out in the disk. And so most of the mass of the disk is here. And you can see it's dropped maybe a factor of 10 in mass due to accreting onto the star. But it's also spread. You can see it spreading out to, 1,000, 10,000 AU because viscosity is spreading the material. Now, you could ask, well, when does this viscously evolving disk go optically thin? We observe disks to go optically thin in a few million years. And you can see that to be optically thin, if you were interstellar dust, the surface density to go optically thin is about 10 to the minus 3. And so you can see that it's thick, way out there for 10 million years. Now, it's true that the dust isn't interstellar dust, but even if you reduce the opacity of the dust by coagulation, and for example, by a factor of 1,000, you still would be, optically thick out to hundreds of AU. And that's not observed. So just viscosity can't explain why disks are disappearing. And they're not putting the stuff into planets either. So something else is going on. One thing that could be going on is that the dust is coagulating into such big rocks that you just lose all opacity. I mean, that's possible, I guess.
Wait, why isn't it going into planets? Because you lost 90% of your mass by the viscosity, so why couldn't the other 10% go into planets?
Well, I mean, we start off with a tenth of a solar mass, so that would be putting 1% in, which is a little high compared with what's observed. It's more like 0.1%.
Okay.
So here's what I think. I mean, if you put evaporation in, first thing we did was we put EUV evaporation in. And I don't know if you're going to compare these two slides, but notice, went the wrong way. I mean, I didn't put them quite on the same scale, but you can see that nothing happens. Absolutely nothing happens with the EUV in. And this is a very high EUV field, too. I have assumed 10 to the minus 2 solar luminosity is in EUV. I don't think you want to go much higher than that for these Lyman continuum photons. So nothing happens. The disk is just too massive. The EUV can't punch a hole at 1 AU because the accretion rate that replaces it is just doing it as fast as it's trying to get rid of stuff here, and virtually nothing happens. So now let's look if you just add FUV and X-rays. Oops, I'm sorry. No, this is a different slide. Sorry, I forgot. So now let's go a little bit longer in evolution. Let's go instead of the last slide went to 10 million years. Now we're going to go to 22 million years. And now you see what Doug has shown and Kathy Clark group has shown, that when, eventually you get what's called the UV switch. As you evolve the disk, its surface density gets lower and lower, and its accretion rate from the outer disk to the inner disk gets lower and lower. Finally, you get to the point where the photoevaporation rate due to the CUV equals that accretion rate in. And then you start to see this little kink? That's it trying to eat a hole. And then at the next time step, and look at how these time steps are very close together, suddenly you produce a hole or a gap, and you see a little bit here of this inner disk, which is draining onto the star by this very short viscous time scale of getting stuff from 1 AU onto the star, which is like 10 to the 4 years. And then after that, you have this torus of material going from a few AU out to, 10,000 AU. And then that gets eaten from the inside out by this EUV photons. And very rapidly, you get this torus going further and further out and just being eaten away by the EUV photons from the star. in a very rapid time scale. So what happens is that the inner disk goes, but the outer disk goes very rapidly as well. And the time scale for this all that sort of disappears is very short compared with this 20 million year time scale. And that, Kathy Clark called the UV switch. But now let's put FUV in. What does FUV do? Well, look, what if we include FUV at just the 10 to the minus 3 level, which is 10 times less than the EUV, look what happens. That FUV can evaporate the outer disk very readily. And so you see that at first viscosity spreads it a little bit, but then very rapidly the FUV is starting to get rid of all this reservoir of gas, and you're losing a tremendous amount of mass in the disk. And in a few million years, basically the whole disk disappears. And it's because the FUV just took out all of this gas out to about 50 AU, and then the viscous timescale from 50 AU inward is only a few million years, and so it just went into the star. And so the whole disk disappears on a few million year timescale.
Does this create a problem with the existence of the Kuiper belt?
Well, the interesting thing about FUV is that the Kuiper belt supposedly has a very sharp edge. I don't know, there's at about 50 AU. And one possibility is that it is this FUV cutoff, which is, you can see how steep the thing is cut off. It has sort of cut that off at a very early time.
But then why did it stop and give the Kuiper belt time to form?
Well, but we observe that most disks do disappear in a few million years time scale. So unless the sun was a lot different than all these other disks we've observed.
So is the idea that the Kuiper belt sort of formed where, you know, there's some well-defined timescale to form the Kuiper belt, and sort of you photoevaporate inward, and then at some time you form the Kuiper belt, and the Kuiper belt ends where, you know, however far the disk had been eaten away at the time you put the stuff into grains that could no longer...
Sort of. I mean, the thing you have to realize, when we evaporate gas, and the gas drags along small dust. But it's only capable of driving dust that's maybe less than 10 microns in size, or maybe 100 microns in size. So all the stuff that's coagulated bigger than that out here will remain. And so you still will have, if in this few million years out there you formed pebbles and little rocks and comets and so forth, they will stay there. And they will be able to perhaps build bigger things as long as they are bigger than this critical size. So you could have a situation with the outer disks, you know, things that are a millimeter or bigger in size that still can evolve to form larger things. But you realize that the time to coagulate gets longer and longer as you go out. So one thing that could happen, that this cutoff could mean that, you know, out beyond some radius, you've evaporated it before it had time to coagulate into stuff that could remain.
We'll give you a nice time scale. What is your FUV flux out at a few hundred AU compared to the interstellar radiation field? How much higher are you?
At a few hundred AU?
Yeah. I'm curious, because you've got such better geometry from the interstellar radiation field. You don't have to get through all the junk inside of it.
Yeah.
Is this just happening because it doesn't even matter?
We include the interstellar radiation field in these calculations, but okay. Let's see. I should know that off the top of my head. I think it's of order sort of 100 times at 100 AU.
Okay, even at 100 AU. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Dave, earlier you had a slide where you said FUV with quotes equals FUV plus X.
Oh, that was because these plots that say only FUV, I realized later, what we mean is that we didn't have EUV, but we did have FUV and X-rays in here. But it's usually the FUV that dominates the heat, and the X-rays we haven't found to be that important, although they are important at a kind of 20%, 30% level in some regions.
And if you have viscosity, that must be due to the X-rays, because otherwise you wouldn't have enough ion.
Oh, absolutely. The X-rays are very important to the MRI turbulence, if that's what's driving alpha.
The timescales seem very short, right? So is the assumption that you have a disk that looks like this to begin with actually a good one?
No, these timescales are perfect. That my point of this talk is that the observations show that the disks do become optically thin and basically disappear. I mean, there's a lot of scatter, but in general, they disappear in a few million year timescales.
I'm curious as of how the protostar forms, so if I compare it to the Kevin Helmholtz times of these stars, you know, as the protostars form,
yeah,
whether the initial disk that you get actually already looks quite significantly different.
It becomes an initial conditions problem. In some sense, the disk may be growing, and during the early stage where the disk was growing, you should be starting this before we even started disks that are 100 AU in size, for example, one of the questions, or it's accreting mass, and we're removing mass.
That's a scale of tens of thousands of years when it's growing.
Out at 100 AU?
Yeah, well, I think most of the accretion occurs at early times.
Yeah, I think the thought is that, you know, when a low mass star forms, there's a period of period of pretty rapid accretion, sort of 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year. So maybe it takes 100,000 years or somewhat less to actually grow the star. And at that point, you're getting such heavy accretion that you probably build up a disk that's gravitationally unstable, which is feeding the star at that same rate. I mean, the material falls on the disk, and then the disk transports it onto the star.
That's why I'm asking, because actually if I compare, you know, 1 million years, it would drop by a factor of 10 in mass on your field already. So you
right.
100,000-year time scale. It's already important.
Yeah,
I think the idea is that as long as you're accreting onto the star, or an idea is as long as you're accreting onto the star, you'll bottle up a lot of the radiation. You know, as long as you're dumping material onto the stellar surface, you'll just absorb the photons, you know, sort of at the stellar surface, and they won't get out. So it's when, you know, so it might be a phenomenon that when you stop accreting, all of a sudden the radiation is free to escape. And
right. No, that is certainly true. In fact, now I'm beginning to understand your question better with that answer. 10 minutes. That's fine. I think we'll get it. I assume that the questions are count. I mean, it's sort of a total time of 45, and that's right. We'll be fine. We'll be fine. We're only a couple more of you guys. So I understand your question better now. And as you're accreting, when you're in the initial stages, when you're accreting, those initial accretion rates onto the star from the disk are like 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year, or 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. And at that point, you have protostellar winds, we know, that are sort of proportional to the accretion rate onto the star. And so I've done a calculation of what's the opacity in the wind for the EUV, and it's just totally opaque. As long as the wind is strong, you don't get any EUV photons out to shine on the disk. And you've got to get the accretion rates down to like 10 to the minus 9 solar masses per year before the EUV even gets a chance to get out.
Unless we can get EUV from those outflows.
Okay, if we get strong shocks that somehow, then yeah, maybe.
Ziani and I have talked about that.
But the EUV opacity, which is hydrogen atoms, is just so high that doesn't get out. Now the FUV and X-rays are more penetrating, but if you are actually accreting at rates of 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, it's probable that the wind itself is opaque to both FUV and X-rays. You get columns through the wind at that point of like 10 to the 24. And so even if there isn't much dust there, there's enough gas opacity to FUV and X-rays to actually take out a lot of the heating X-rays in FUV. So I think there is a somewhat of a delay until the accretion rate starts to drop onto the star due to this opacity in the wind that's coming up. Now this is when we combine these two. Remember what the FUV only did. It basically truncated the disk, took out a lot of mass, and that caused the disk to lose mass fairly rapidly. If you add the EUV now, what happens is that the FUV has accelerated the demise of the surface density of the disk because it's taken out this reservoir. And so the accretion rate through 1 AU drops much more rapidly than it did if you didn't have the FUV. And so very much more rapidly you get this EUV eating this hole in. And so you can see that this fourth contour here is at 2.6 million years, and you can see that the EUV is eating the hole. There's a hole there, and there's this inner gas and dust, and then there's an outer gas and dust with a little hole, a little gap. And then another tenth of a million years, you don't see any of the inner gas because it's all viscously accreted onto the star, and you have a torus here of gas between 10 AU and 100 AU. It's being eaten from the inside by the EUV and from the outside by the FUV and X-rays. And so you have this sort of shrinking torus that lasts for just a short period of time. And it's true that this would then say that if you see toruses of gas where you have a hole and you have an optically thick outer disk, that they don't last very long. And so that's why you don't see very many of them. They only see one or 10% of the sources have had these sort of situations. So I'm almost done, Chris. This is a plot of just the mass in the disk as a function of time now, because what I've been showing before have just been surface densities as a function of time. But this is the total mass in the disk. This is with just viscosity, and you can see the mass starts off at 0.1. We're starting at 1 million years now. So at t equals 0, it was 0.1 solar masses, and then it's dropping as things spread and stuff accretes onto the star. And at 100 million years, you still have quite a bit of mass. It's just spread out. Some of it's going under the star. If you just add EUV, as you saw in that plot, eventually the EUV burns a hole, and that then very rapidly gets rid of the rest of the disk at that point. And so that happens here at 25 million years or so, in this case, with a fairly healthy dose of EUV. Then if you put FUV, you get the FUV, you can see that it gets rid of material even in the first million years. I mean, it is fast getting rid of that outer stuff. It just, you know, it heats that up and it drives that loosely bound outer stuff out. And then it's dropping due to FUV. And so that in just a 3 million years or something, it's really gone to very negligible masses left in the disk. With the EUV added, you then have a much more rapid cutoff in the mass, because all of a sudden the EUV burns a hole, and then that even more rapidly gets rid of the disk. And so you get a little bit of a difference. So that actually is the last slide. Then the summaries are that photoevaporation is the dominant dispersal mechanism for the outer disk beyond several AU. Disk is spreading, disperses the inner disk, accretion onto the star, and also spreading out into the region where it photoevaporates. The EUV evaporation causes this gap at a few AU, and then viscous accretion creates an inner hole because the inside gas very rapidly accretes onto the star. And then the EUV rapidly evaporates the outer torus from the inside out. But this only operates once the disk has lost mass and the accretion rate through the disk has fallen to these very low values. And I've referenced Clark, and I'm sorry, Doug, I should have referenced you as well and your work. It was very nice work.
You saw those work, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And then photoevaporation, the bottom line is that photoevaporation by FUV and X-rays photoevaporates from the outside in, and it evaporates the main mass reservoir, and thus it determines the lifetime. I think that that's the thing, that's the key to determining why did this only last a few million years. It's because they're being photoevaporated by not the EUV, but the FUV and X-rays, which are taking the mass reservoir out and sort of shrinking things from the outside in.
In your previous plot, that's something you should really stress, I guess. There was a wonderful paper by Steve Rudin, right, where he was looking at what we were doing with the EUV and pointing out that despite all the discussions, all of the mass was being lost to viscous evolution and accreting onto the central star. And it was only, as you said, the finite last little bit where we suddenly were able to get rid of things. But in your case, the FUV is really removing the dominant mass reservoir.
Right.
And so that's what that changes the character entirely.
Right.
I think that's the that would be an important plot, is to show who took the mass.
Right.
Right. Because in all the other ones, it all goes to accretion, and then that sets the stage.
Okay. Let's thank Dave.
What will happen if instead of having uniform X-ray flux, you have flares? Very intense flares,
as they are observed. Yeah. I think that we looked a little bit at that, and that the timescales for those flares, I forget, they're like on orders of days or something like this, and hours, days. And the thing is that the timescale to sort of get to reach a thermal equilibrium is much, much longer than that. And so, I mean, it's not like the temperature of the disk would suddenly go up for a day and then go down for a day. You've got sort of this inertia of heating, and so that it doesn't really, what you want is sort of what is the average X-ray luminosity, because that's all that's important. You want to sort of...
successive bursts.
Right. If you have a bunch of bursts and then you want to do is average it over periods of years to see, you know, because the time scales for the thermal balance and so forth are of that order. They're long.
Any more questions?
Okay.
That's right. Oh, we have questions. Lots of ask more questions.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's thank Dave again. Yeah.